Do you prefer to be called Anne or Annie?
Annie.
Okay. I have the feeling it's clear to me that you don't mind the word faith, that maybe you even like it. You subtitled your book with it, Some Thoughts on Faith. And I just want to start by asking, what do you like about that word? What images does it conjure up for you, or what stories?
Well, I love the word faith because it's so ecumenical. I would also describe myself as a religious woman because I'm very committed to a path of Christianity that's probably more free form than a lot of people's Christianity. But I worship with great devotion and consistency. But I really don't like religions, and I'm somebody who's very opposed to most religions, and certainly the fundamental wings of them all. But sober people say that religion is for people who are afraid to go to hell, and spirituality is for people who've been there. And I think faith for me is a word that speaks much more to spirituality and to a belief and an interest in matters that are spiritual rather than the institution and creeds that you associate with religion.
But you do hold that together with being, you don't like religions, but you are a religious person.
Right? Yeah.
Okay. And you grew up, without faith or religion, I think.
Well, I grew up with faith. I always believed that there was a God. I always believed that when I whispered hello, that there was somebody who heard and who stayed very close to me. But I was raised to be an atheist by very staunch atheists. And I was one of those rare kids who snuck off to church with various friends from different denominations, Catholic and Christian Scientist and Episcopal, and I always loved church. I really love the ritual. I love the ritual. I love the faith. I love the meditation. I love the candles. I love the truth that underpins religion. But I just can't stand organized religion, and I can't stand the religious right in this country. I would consider it one of my great enemies. Enemies to the spirit and enemies to the heart and souls of children who then grow up to be adults who are very, very wounded by dogmatism and guilt and shame.
And, in your book, Traveling Mercies, you say a few times that, that your parents didn't like Christians or your father didn't like Christians and you didn't like them either. And I have a feeling it wasn't just all religious people, but especially Christians who could be offensive. I mean, what was it?
I think that the right-wing Christian sector of the population has always seemed a very obviously dangerous group of people because they're so convinced that they're right, and that means that you're wrong. My father was raised in Japan. His parents were Presbyterian missionaries, and so he grew up just seeing a lot of hypocrisy and coldness. He called Presbyterians God's frozen people, and he didn't see warmth and joy and spirit and nurture and soul made manifest in the practice of Christianity. And so it seemed like if it doesn't bring you more to life, what's the point? And if it doesn't give you that a spiritual awakening, but instead keeps you kind of numbed out or convinced that you're right and that your actions are going to get you a really nice seat in heaven, then it's pretty meaningless stuff. And both my parents were very left-wing, bohemian, jazz aficionados. I think my father converted to poetry and jazz at about the age of 14, even though he was still in a church family in Tokyo. And I was just raised hearing that it was just all a crock, and that, I was always raised protesting and being an activist against the dogma of the Christian right. I was always outside San Quentin protesting the death penalty and protesting executions. My dad actually taught at San Quentin. Yeah. And I was very early a person who marched for women's rights and abortion rights. And all of my political and my father's and mother's political beliefs were anathema to the Christian right, and so I knew that I was just considered a major blight, and just felt, you know, that a person who would have been shamed in a Christian right family for falling so far short of the ideals. So, but I always believed in God, and I went through a brief period in high school where my friend Pammy and I were so appalled by this huge wave of Christian conversion that my favorite teacher sort of led. She became a born-again Christian one summer, and everybody flocked to her when school started again, and Pammy and I just felt so ostracized and kind of like the village hunchbacks, you know, these bitter, crabby people where all these new Christians were sitting under the trees at this tiny little school I went to, praying and singing and being sweet. It was really nauseating. I have to say, it was really hard to take. And so we became very staunch atheists, but it was brief. I always knew or believed that I knew that there was a God, that there was goodness, that there was good orderly direction, that there was an underlying truth that was not visible to the human eye.
You know, something that strikes me when you talk about the kinds of things your parents were involved in, the kinds of things that you were involved in that seem to be in contrast to the Christian right, are actually ways of living that you now associate with faith, with acting out of faith. I mean, taking care of people and standing up for life against the death penalty in that case.
Women's rights.
Yeah, women. Well, I mean, what do you think? Is there a motivation in that that maybe approximates faith, but has been turned away by the language and the structures, but in some ways is still part of the same experience that you have now that you call Christianity?
No, I don't think that's how I would express it. I would say that a lot of the people I march with against the war and against the policies of the Bush administration, and a lot of people with whom I march are Christians. A lot of them are Jews, and a lot of them are Buddhists. And so we all share a very, very deep faith. And then half of them are atheists, but we share a very deep faith in human rights, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights. So I don't really call anything Christianity except for this sort of overarching specter of conservative Christianity. I don't believe that I have a single interesting theological understanding of much of anything of Christ or Jesus, or I don't know who shot the Holy Spirit or where how it all shakes down in the end, but I just love Jesus. And so it's been very easy for people to label me a born-again Christian because I was not specifically a Christian until 17 years ago. And I converted drunk, which is to say that I stopped leaving this funny little integrated church where I'd found my way to. I wasn't leaving for the sermons anymore. It was mostly what my conversion began as. Before the conversion, I just left for the really heavily Jesus parts and wanted to be there for the songs and the warmth and the kindness.
I mean, I noticed you really were drawn in by the music for a long time more than the words, right?
Right. And then after my conversion, I had a really deep hunger and thirst for a deeper connection with Jesus as I experienced Jesus, which was sort of like Casper the Friendly Ghost, that I could call on his name. I could call him and I could hear him say hi like an older brother. I wrote about it in Traveling Mercies as feeling like this little feral kitten was running beside me and that I was kind of nudging it with my feet, trying to get it to go away because I didn't want to be a Christian. And, you know, all of my friends back then were left-wing radical activists, which I was and still am. But for them, Christianity meant, you know, Newt Gingrich or Trent Lott. It was associated with sort of the Southern Baptist or sort of a vaguely racist. But yet there was also the religion and faith of Dr. Martin Luther King, and that had launched the whole civil rights movement. And these are the people with whom I found myself worshiping. And they were all total lovers of Jesus, but they were all total civil rights activists too. Mm-hmm. So I tried very hard not to convert because I thought it would be, it was like, you know, believing in extraterrestrial life or pyramid power. And I tried everything to get rid of this funny little cat at my heels. And finally, I just gave up. Because I'd had this experience I wrote about in Traveling Mercies, where I really, really felt the presence of Jesus hunkered down, bearing witness on this little houseboat I lived on, ironically, a week after an abortion. And
tell that story. It's a beautiful story. Would you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had, I forgot exactly how old I was. I think it was 17 years ago, and I'm going to be 49 soon. So I guess it was, well, you do the math, and 17 years ago. And I had had an abortion, which I didn't have a political problem with, but I had just been really devastated by the belief that I wasn't going to get to have children and that it would keep turning out this way. And I'd been very drunk and stoned on pills and pot ever since the abortion, and very drunk every night. And one night I started hemorrhaging. I couldn't stop the blood flow, and it was very scary. I got sobered up very quickly. I mean, you know, instantly. But I wouldn't call the doctor, and I wouldn't call a friend, because I had such self-loathing that a woman who had had an abortion was so drunk a week later, let alone a night later. And so I just lay there in bed trying to tend to it, and feeling very frightened, though, and not positive I wasn't dying. And before dusk, I felt this presence of a man hunkered down in the corner of a tiny houseboat. And I had felt that presence in my dad's being, or in an experience of my father showing up since his death, whenever I was very, very alone and freaked out or troubled or coming off bad drugs or whatever. I just kind of feel my dad bearing witness and keeping me company. And I felt the man this time that night, and I absolutely knew who it was. I knew it was Jesus, and I didn't feel like he was hassling me or trying to get me to sign on the dotted line or to sit up and go, "Yes, Lord, thank you, Lord," you know, but that he was just there. And I turned to the wall and I said, "I would rather die than say yes to this," because I really at that point would have. And the sun came up and I stopped bleeding, and I thought, well, I'm just losing my mind is all, and that's fine. And better than the other, better than becoming a born-again Christian type. And after that, though, I started to feel this kitten or this little cat running at my feet. And I'd always been going to this, I'd been going to this church for a while, drunk and just sick. I was also sick from bulimia, and I often couldn't stand up, but I really did love the music. And I can sing with a crowd really joyfully, whereas I don't sing well on my own. And I always left for the Jesus talk, though. It made me want to run screaming for my cute little life, because it was so nuts to believe in the presence of a dead guy and who was God. It just was more than I could grasp. And after I had this experience, I sort of felt like I was surrendering. I was just giving up. You know, it's like they say surrender means that you just run out of bullets. And I was kind of tired of fighting. And at one point I said a swear word. And then after that, I said, "Okay, you can come on in." And I've ever since that moment just felt that Jesus was with me and in my heart and in this room. Like there's a sound technician and a puppy, and me in this little room. And I feel that there are four of us, and I just experience it as there being four of us. But it's very easy to pin me as a born again Christian, which sounds a little bit more born again Christian-y than I feel.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I mean, I'm not going to pin you anywhere. You say you don't have much theology, but I think what you do is theology. I mean, I think Traveling Mercies is a book of theology, because it's just making words about God and trying to describe the presence of God in real life. I mean, uh-huh. For me, that's what theology is. I also, just in terms of distinguishing between faith and religion, how they're connected, how they're not connected. I mean, I almost feel when I read you and when I hear you speak that that the figure of Jesus is the overwhelming presence for you, the religious experience. It's almost as though I feel like you could have Jesus in your life without going to church.
Well, I don't know that I could, because like last night I went to church, and today we're taping this on the day that America is probably going to start bombing Iraq.
Yeah,
I went to church last night for a meeting because I'm an elder at my little church, and which is like I'm on the governing board, and I didn't want to go. I'd much rather lie on the couch and watch CNN and eat chocolate, but I went, and it's so shored up my faith. It's so made me stop trying to get my really damaged, wild, angry, afraid mind to be the solution to a wild, angry, afraid mind. And I just surrendered all over again, and something settled down into me, and I remembered that I don't worship a God of circumstances, and I don't hope that this or that happens. I have my hope in the fact that there is goodness, and that God's hand is in this, and that I can be God's hand, and I can be his eyes or her eyes, and that a whole lot of us are going to take care of one another and take care of everyone we can, which is something that people in the spiritual and religious communities do, which is that, you know, it's like in the Christian tradition, they say that faith without works is dead, and that it's just meaningless if you're not just pushing back your sleeves and giving thirsty people glasses of water and whatever food you can share and a little bit of time and a listening ear. So church is like the gas station for me, you know?
Yeah.
I go there and I fill back up and I'm temporarily well again. But one thing you said interested me, which was that I've been very angry at God lately and basically not speaking to him or her. But don't ever lose my faith in Jesus and talk to Jesus all the time. I'm wearing a Mary medallion right now because I also happen to really love Mary, although that's not a traditionally Protestant thing to do. But when I was on using cocaine and methadrine, and I was coming off of it all those years ago, I used to just hail Mary 1,000 times to keep my mind tethered to my body and not to just go over to the other side and not be able to get back. And so my during Ash Wednesday, a few Wednesdays ago, we get to go up to the altar and make a just make a confession of either joy and gratitude or of what we're really hoping for in Lent. The transformation we're hoping for, and the restoration and healing, both in the world and in our own troubled minds. And I went up and I said, I'm just so mad at God. I just think this is a lousy system, and that children suffer the most and die, and that really, really awful people, and I won't name names, get to make decisions that just have horrific, devastating effects on the world. But I never stopped thinking of Jesus as this incredibly kind, gentle presence, like I felt him that day on the houseboat when I was hemorrhaging after an abortion. So that's what I mean. I don't have interesting theological insight, because Jesus is God and is an elder brother, was God in the form of an elder brother for us, who came to teach us that we were all one and we were all one family, and that everybody gets to eat. And that,
but that is all theology. It is. I mean,
is it? Oh, that's funny, because I don't understand much of anything.
But I mean, also where you've gotten in your own life with all of its circumstances is that your faith and your belief in Jesus is a presence in every moment, but that you need the community. I mean, this is also
definitely
where the Christian church came to in the first century, right?
Yeah.
Even though people are flawed, and the more people get involved, the more trouble there is, right?
Yeah. People are flawed, but also the more people there are, the more it's like pain shared is pain divided. And the more, and when you have a community, like in the very, very first days of the Christian church there, it really sounds like a commune, you know, where people shared in the work and took care of one another and divided up the chores, and they spent half of the day in prayer and meditation and
a lot of them were outcasts in their own way too. A lot of them were outcasts in their own way,
and almost all of them were outcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the people that the society said were the very, very least: the women, the poor, the hookers, the drunks. And Jesus's very radical message said, "Oh no! If you want to find me, come hang with these people, because this is where I'm going to be." And I'm going to be with the people who don't seem to have any worldly power, because the illusion of worldly power means you just are, you know, you're on the wrong sheet of music. And so But community for me, the reason I believe so strongly in Jesus and in God, I'm not mad at God today, but I think that's because we just got a puppy. But the reason I believe it so strongly is because of the love of my friends and the love of my church. I mean, you should have seen the raggedy-ass shape I was in when I arrived. And I was bulimic, and so I was weak a lot. I weighed no pounds, and plus I thought I was better than everybody. So it was like I had no self-esteem, but I thought I was better than everybody. And this community never hassled me. And when I had my child, I didn't have a cent. And they were like this nest underneath me that held me up, that, you know, that it, at least in my community, the community involves a lot of casseroles, and it involves visiting. Right. It coming over and bringing you chocolate and watching TV with you could be the most spiritual thing anyone could do for you that day. It's just willing to come over and hang with you, you know, So,
but I don't want to belabor this, but I think again that's also it's great theology. I mean, a lot of people feel like they have to make a distinction between faith and religion or spirituality and religion. But we also, I mean, we talk about churches as buildings or institutions, right? The institution of religion, but your church is people. It's all about incarnation.
It's all about
the whole experience, right?
There's a crucifix in the next town over that is had it's a very big wooden crucifix from like 400 years ago, and it has his arms blown off, and then there's a sign underneath it that says Jesus has no arms but ours to do his work and to show his love. And my experience and what I've learned at my church mostly, which is half black and very southern and very civil rights, and is that you can't know Jesus but through the children of God, the very troubled, screwed up, kind of nutty people that, you know, nutty people are us, damaged people are us. And that's how I know Jesus, is in very, very loving eyes and gentle hands and people that get out of themselves to become people for others, which is sometimes me. Sometimes I'm the one getting out of myself, and other times people have just given up what they really thought they needed to do to just come be with me, or to take me up on the mountain, or to the movies, or have lain down on the floor with me when I was too sad to get up.
I almost don't want to get into this with you because I think I'd love to talk to you about it for hours. And it's, I want to talk about what you've learned about the nature of faith through being a mother. And you write so much about your son. And I actually feel like I have children also. I think when you bring a child into the world, you learn a little bit more about, you know, what it means to be God, right? Not to overstate that, but it's much more about being vulnerable than it is about being powerful.
Right.
And I think you write about that beautifully. You know, what you tell some stories in Traveling Mercies about faith and life with your son Sam. If I just ask you the question this way, you know, what do you think, how has being a mother changed your faith or enriched it? You know, what comes to mind?
Well, boy, it's sort of like saying, how has having a child changed your life? First of all, having a child so kicks to pieces the illusion that you're in charge of much, or that your ideas are good ideas and that people will just naturally follow them because they make sense, because a kid is just like the ultimate anarchist. I mean, really worse than a puppy, or about the same. And so what happened for me was that terrible, terrible miracle that my heart opened in a way it hadn't been opened before. And before I had a child, I felt like I'd had a great life and a hard life. And I sort of felt like, hit me with your best shot, because I was 35 when I delivered. I was 34 when I got pregnant. I felt like I've lived hard. I'd had a lot of books come out. I'd had a lot of success. I'd had some failure. I'd had a million relationships. And when I had a baby, I became so desperate and clingy, and all I wanted was to live, you know, and raise my child. Mm-hmm. And the main thing I wanted was just for him to outlive me.
Right.
But then at the same time, I became much, much more desperate and clingy about life, because I felt like it would be so awful for him to have his mother die. And I became, you know, the desperation is not a bad thing. And in the New Testament, it says that God's strength is made perfect in our weakness, and that it really shows, you know, when you're just at the end of your rope and you're really mentally ill and exhausted and weepy, and you realize you don't like children, and yet you remember to pray or to write a little note and put it in the God box, which I wrote a lot about in operating instructions,
yeah.
And you get an answer to your prayer for help or stamina or direction or discernment. It is so deep. The relief is so deep. And the gratitude for an answered prayer is so great when your kid has a 105-degree fever in the middle of the night, or and you're in another country, or Sam went through a cancer scare when he was six, and Sam met his father when he was seven, and they established a relationship. And it was all such brand new territory. I didn't have any kind of operating instructions or owner's manual to go with, you know, 105-degree fevers, or fathers who we hadn't seen for 7 years, or the threat of cancer and oncology appointments, which and one step at a time, I was given enough light to see by, and I was given really incredible company, and I could feel the presence of God in that really steadfast company. And I couldn't get so crazy or so terrified that I could that I could lose the love of God. And I mostly don't hear from God. I never hear from God like by megaphone or skywriting.
Oh, I do like, all the time. Yeah.
I know, it'd be like it would be so much skin off God's nose just to let me know that things are, you know, it, in a written form,
write a
that
letter.
Things are gonna be okay.
Yeah.
But I do hear from God from friends and from the stuff that I read and in the Bible and in the books people are writing these days, which are just much more wild and funny and tenderer and more vulnerable than they used to be, because I think because of all the movements, the women's movement and the movement of third world spirituality and the gay movement and just the movements of spirit in the last 30 years. But at any rate, I do hear from God, and I am given enough to keep going. And you know, just to mix topics for a second, it's a little bit like with writing. It's like that wonderful line of E.L. Doctorow's that writing is like driving at night with the headlights on, and you can't see very far, but you can make the whole journey that way. And having a kid and being a woman of faith is means that I can't see far. I don't know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm going to see along the way, but I know that I'll be sustained, and I know I won't be alone.
Yeah. That's great. You know, I think one reason that you've touched such a chord and that people enjoy your writing so much and are touched by it is because you're writing out of the real messy stuff of life. And in fact, you know, when I read Traveling Mercies, I think you've had a lot of loss and grief in your life. I mean, we all do, but you've had a lot, and you've put it down on paper. And I want to read a passage that particularly touched me. All those years I fell for the great palace lie that grief should be gotten over as quickly as possible and as privately, but what I've discovered since is that the lifelong fear of grief keeps us in a barren, isolated place, and that only grieving can heal grief. The passage of time alone without the direct experience of grief will not heal it. And then you write, San Francisco is a city in grief. We are a world in grief, and it is at once intolerable and a great opportunity. You know, and as you and I are talking today, we're our country is now moving into is in the next phase of the war on terror, whatever that's going to be. I mean, I we are a nation in grief right now, or we will be soon. And you know, I wonder how you think about. You did tell the story about being at your church last night. I mean, how would you want to think with people now about where faith fits into all this, into this opportunity? You know, does it help? Does it help? And if it helps, then how does it help? Even if things don't seem to be, if things seem to be unfolding badly.
Well, I think things are already unfolding just horrifically, whether or not, however the war shakes down. And I don't consider this a war on terrorism in Iraq. I consider it a war on Iraq. But Faith is a verb, you know, is I think the difference between faith and religion. And the verb is that what joins all of us in faith, all people of all faiths, I think, is that we believe in a variation of the golden rule or karma, that you get back what you put in, and that if you want apricots, you're not going to grow them from tomato seeds or arugula seeds, and that we're here to take care of one another, and that if we want to have loving feelings, we need to do loving things. That it's really an action word, faith is. It's not dithery, and it's not about ideals and gentle little hymns, although I love gentle hymns. But so in this time that I would characterize right now as a very, very profound depression and terror in this country, the people of faith somehow know that, as I said earlier, God's hand is in it, that nothing can separate us from the love of God, and that it's the same God yesterday as it will be today at 5 when we meet the deadline, and as it ever will be, and that the truth of our spiritual identity is not dependent on circumstance, and the truth of our spiritual identity is that I believe we're children of God, and I believe this to be true about Jews and Muslims and Hindus and atheists. I just believe we were created by the loving presence that we would call God or goodness or truth. And so the people of faith know that that if you just show up and you're willing to help and you're willing to have a tiny, tiny spiritual awakening such as that you don't kill yourself that day or try to kill anybody else, that things are going to work out. And they're going to work out one day at a time, but they're also going to work out tribally. And so we stick together, and it means we stick together in churches, we huddle, we pray, we meditate, we sing, and we dance together, even when our hearts are breaking, because there's not a lot of hope or help in our minds. The mind, for me, is where almost all of my problems lie, which is to say that I'm on my own mind almost all the time, and so there's not going to be a lot of healing in that situation. And so we show up at church, and we show up at candlelight vigils, and we show up at the homes of the people that are too old and frail now to come be with us in other in an organized way. We go to them, and we show up. I think, back before I turned on Woody Allen, I used to love that line. He said that 80% of life is just showing up. And the people of faith show up. Now political activists show up too. And I think it's a very, very faithful community, whether they experience it with any kind of divine or spiritual sense at all, or whether they really experience it as just their humanity manifesting itself in the tender care of brothers and sisters who aren't doing as well. But, spirit is not... spirit and soul are a part of every single person's makeup. They just are. I mean, they're what animate us. It's what animates what would otherwise be this cold, lumpy clay body that is left behind when we die. And we know that's not who we are. That's like the car that got us around in this incarnation or life. And so spirit can come together from all sorts of different religions and recognize itself as being truth that is expressed in with whole different uniforms and dress codes and rules of behavior, of engagement, and I can get together with an arch right wing Christian, and I could get together with Andrew Sullivan, who's arch right wing, and he and I could just go to the fact that we adore Jesus, live by Jesus, and believe he's the King of Kings and the King of Peace, and he and I could just jam forever. So it's a unification. It's not a division into who believes what and whether they're right. That's why I'm opposed to religion, because each religion believes it's secretly right, and that each religion believes that it's going to get all the really good seats in heaven, if not all of them.
Yeah, but
it's like my friend Tom W., who's a Jesuit, says you can tell you've created God in your own image when he hates all the same people you do. And I'm sure politically Andrew Sullivan would really be horrified with me, because I am a left-wing radical activist. I mean, not radical, but very far left. And yet at the same time, we could sit together and we could pray all day. And so I could go to his church and he could go to mine and I would wash his feet and I believe he would wash mine.
But look, you know, you keep doing in one in the same breath, you damn religion, and then you're talking like the most religious person I've ever spoken with, right? And I think part of the problem is, there are a few people who are setting a bad example, but it's also we've had to adopt their vocabulary and their words and their ways of describing what religion is, right? So, I mean, I think part of my task is saying I'm doing this program called Speaking of Faith. I want to inject some new vocabulary and some new images into the discussion. And, I mean, you're a wordsmith. You know what? Tell me what words and vocabulary and pictures you want to throw out there when people think of religion so that they start thinking of someone more like you, perhaps. Or that you come into the picture with Andrew Sullivan.
Well, I think what I want, just to clarify things for a second, I really believe that fundamentalism is the great evil on this earth right now and from every different religious tradition. And that the fundamentalists that form a certain percent of each religion are the reason we're going to go to Iraq tonight and destroy a country where 50% of the population is children. It's our fundamentalists. It's their fundamentalists. It's a conviction of being right and a feeling that we are chosen and that other people can be denied a seat at the banquet table. Whereas I believe that people of faith and in spiritual communities understand that everybody is a child of God and everybody needs to be fed and that you just don't get to pick who you're going to sit with at the banquet, you know, so buckle your seatbelt. But the images, there's a, I have a picture on my, in my living room, a little card of a swan on water with six baby swans. There's a word for them, but I can't think of what it is. But the little babies, and they're all nestled on her back and sort of shielded in her wings, and she's going to carry them safely across the water. And I really love that image. And in the Bible, in one of the Psalms, and I don't think I could find it right now, although I could try, it says that the Psalms are so profound right now because this is a period of such lamentation. And I think lamentation is a great religious word.
Yeah, good.
And it certainly captures where we were at the Peace March and where we are crying out in grief, don't do this, don't do this war, it's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. I think lamentation is a word that ought to be used much more. But in this psalm, and the psalms are all about very, very old people or people right on the edge. It's hard to understand them if you're not really just about to tip over into the abyss. But one of the psalms says that we will be protected under God's loving arms, underneath the wings of a great mother bird. And I really feel that. I feel that when I pray, when I stop. When I turn off the TV and I stop and I get quiet and I close my eyes, then I'm under the protection of a great mother duck, you know? I just want to tell you one quick story from church on Sunday. During the children's sermon, our pastor, Veronica, was teaching them about taking spiritual timeouts all day and that that you could stop and close your eyes. And then she had them do that. And she said, what do you hear? And they're all different ages from about 3 till 12. And they're saying, oh, I hear dogs. I hear a radio. I hear someone singing. I hear the wind. I hear lots of birds. And then this 4-year-old boy said, I hear the water at the edges. And I thought, who's writing your stuff? And then I wanted to go up to him and say, hey, can I use that? I'm a writer. Can I use that? Were you going to use that? And so it's like the water at the edges, I think, is the water holding us up is a great religious image from the Bible, which is mostly what I read spiritually. People send me a lot of Buddhist and Hindu poems, and I love them also. And half of my friends are Jews, and they give me a lot of stuff that they think I would love and that would really resonate for me. And a lot of the poetry I read is written by atheists and people of, you know, bohemian and naturalistic and Walt Whitman and Emerson sensibility. And it all tends to the spirit. It all tends to the soul. But when all is said and done, water is something that is a part of almost all religions. And the sense of the baptism, the being washed clean in the water, the fact that it slakes our thirst, that in the Christian tradition, it's living water, that the Holy Spirit is the living water poured into us. You know, or in the story by J.D. Salinger. Remember that short story, Teddy? It's at the very, it's the very last story in the nine stories. And it's a little boy who's a reincarnated llama, and he's being interviewed on this cruise ship. And the interviewer, who's like from the BBC or something, is saying, well, when did you first understand what this whole, that everything was God, and that, that, that there was this great spiritual truth to our lives? And this 8-year-old or 9-year-old boy in huge baggy Bermuda shorts says, well, one day I was watching my mother give my sister a glass of milk, and I just could see that it was God pouring God into God. And so the God, the images of God from the Bible and from various religious traditions that sing to me and that I've written so much about are water. That I talk a lot, as you were reading that grief thing, I was thinking how much I talk about grief, because in that same piece it says that grief is the way home. And that we cry and cry, and that opens our heart. It the grief pierces us. That's why having children wedges our hearts open, and it feels awful, and it cracks our hearts open. But then both Leonard Cohen and Rumi, the great Persian mystic, said that there are cracks in everything, and that's how the light gets in. But it's also how the water gets in. And we go from dried, parched people, barely able to think of anything, to having been moistened again. And the tears and the baptism and the water splashed over us and the rain and the tears and all of it and the milk hydrate the ground at our feet, and all sorts of stuff starts to bloom in the desert. You know, the beautiful wildflowers and the beautiful, tiny little hilarious succulents. And so as we're heading into war, and as we're heading into this period of terrifying isolationism and domination and what I would just call imperialism and bullying and meanness and not playing well with others, what really gives me a lot of hope is that we're all gonna stick together, and we're gonna cry, and we're gonna, when some of us feel that our cup is overflowing with blessing or with gratitude or with like to have a puppy, it's a little bit hard to stay that depressed. So I do feel like my cup overflows sometimes, and then I offer it to others. I'm not given a chalice full of cool fresh mountain water so I can hoard it or try to keep it fresh in the refrigerator. The only way I keep it fresh is by giving it away. And then there are many, many times, more often than not, when I need to have a sip from somebody else's cup. And I wrote in that last salon piece that I thought everybody else had this beautiful silver chalice with engraving, and that mine was like a Flintstones grape jelly glass, you know, with Barney Rubble on it. And it turns out everybody's is a grape jelly glass with Barney Rubble or Bam Bam or Pebbles on it. And it is just a container for the water, like our bodies are containers for the Holy Spirit. So when that little kid said, oh, I hear the water at the edges, I thought, yo, little man.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
I don't think we can do better than this.